Thank you, Brother Jack.
We need to get his list sometime and ask him those questions. See how he does them. Well, good to see you here this morning, and good to have you visitors, and hope you'll come back. We are, it's always good to have Michael here. I'll tell you a little story on Michael. When our electricity went off back in December during that ice storm, about noon, my son called and said, "You'd better go to a hotel before they fill up while you can get there." Well, already I have a short drive, but a very steep one, and everything was iced over. And we called three taxi companies. "No, we're not running. We're not running today." And so Ruby called Michael. He owns a limousine service. And so she asked him, "Are you driving?" "Oh, no, I wouldn't get out on this and drive for anything." And she told him our problem. And so he said, "Well, I'm not going to get my limousine out, but I'll bring my car. You just stay right where you are." And took us to a hotel. And we really appreciate that. I tried to pay him. He wouldn't let me pay him. He said, "I'm doing this not just for you. I'm doing it for Jesus." Isn't that good? It really is. So thank you, Michael. And Trudy, you did a good job of raising him. All right. We are in the Minor Prophets. And Ruby was saying on the way to church this morning, would have been... I feel sorry for the prophets and the minor prophets. Nobody listened to them. And, Jesus talked about that when he warns us, be careful if everybody speaks well of you. Actually, in that Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 through 7 goes on to say that, you're blessed when you are persecuted. Because that's what they did to the prophets. And they did. And she said, "I bet they didn't like saying what God told them to say." I said, "Well, I don't like some of the things that are in the Bible either. But if you preach through the Bible, you have to cover them. I mean, they're there. Jesus talked about hell more than he talked about heaven. Hell is not a comfortable subject to speak on. I don't. Best advice I ever heard for preachers is don't ever preach on hell unless you can do it with a broken heart, because some people do it with a sledgehammer." Well, we're in the book of Micah, and it is in this book where the turn takes toward the where these prophecies are not only about what are going to happen immediately, and that's in the northern kingdom of Israel, the fall of Samaria in 722 B.C. to Assyria, and then in the southern kingdom in 586 B.C., the fall to Babylon of Jerusalem. They are the immediate things. But as you look at these prophecies of restoration, they're still out there in the future. Everybody got really excited when... United Nations was formed. The League of Nations had tried to do this, and they were unsuccessful. And so the United Nations was formed in order to have a world body politic to declare Israel and Palestine states, countries. And that was announced in 1947 and be effective in May of 1948. And immediately, that was almost like turning on a red signal prophetically, because when Jesus returns, Jerusalem, he's going to return to Jerusalem. The temple is going to be rebuilt just prior to that. Really, really exciting when you look at all of that. But, you have to look at it with in the Olivet Discourse, Matthew 24, where Jesus is talking about the temple. Tear this temple down 3 days, I'll build it again. They thought he was talking architecturally. He was talking personally. Destroy this temple He was talking about the temple of his body, and I'll raise it again in 3 days. And then they said, you know, well, when is this going to happen? What is the sign of your coming? And so he starts giving signs, plural. And those signs, plural, have happened almost in every generation, certainly in every century since then. Nation will rise against nation, but the end is not yet. And talks about religious persecution, about families, children turning on their parents, parents turning on their children, but the end is not yet. But the end is not yet. And then he says, and this gospel will be preached in all the world as a witness, and then the end shall come. That's why we ought to be interested in missions and evangelism, because it's God's will that the whole world hear of the wonderful story of Jesus and of his death and his burial and his resurrection and his ascension and then his coming return and rule and reign. Does not say that all the world is going to turn to Christ, but it says they're all going to hear. And it's really in the past 50 years that we've had the technology to do that with this. You know, you feel like that you have visited Sochi in Russia. You know, you're there. You read in the book of Revelation that when Elijah and the other unnamed prophet return and they are put to death by the Antichrist, that there are parties held all over the world. That's the technology of satellite television. Because, you know, something happens. We think things are getting worse and worse. I think they've probably been that bad all along. We're just now finding out about them. Because instantly you find out what's going on in the world. All you have to do is go to Facebook. I am not on Facebook. I get students every week, will you connect on? But no, I'm not going to do it. But Ruby is, so she keeps me up to date with what's going on there. You've got these promises in these minor prophets of the destruction, the doom and destruction that's coming to Jerusalem and to Samaria first. But then you have these promises of restoration that are out there still in front of us in the remote future, certainly remote from the time these prophets received that prophecy. You also have the promise of that, but here in Micah, you begin to get into the way that promise is going to be fulfilled. Because Jesus can't come again until he comes for the first time. And it's in Micah chapter 5 that you run into the prophecy of the birth of Christ. Actually, the first verse is really a part of the fourth chapter there. And so the pericope or the paragraph starts with verse 2. But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of you shall come forth to me the one to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth are from of old, from everlasting. And therefore he shall give them up until the time that she who is in labor has given birth. And then the remnant of his brethren will return to the children of Israel. He shall stand and feed his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord of God, and they shall abide. For now he shall be great to the ends of the earth. And this one shall be peace. you've got the first coming in Bethlehem, and then the second coming when he becomes great to the ends of the earth, all in this one little paragraph here. And then the rest of the chapter is about what's going to happen in the immediate future when Assyria comes. When Jesus was born, the wise men over in Babylon, these were the magi, the magicians, and they were astrologers. They came from a class because and we've talked about this before, but those ancient sheiks had harems. You know, even Solomon had, 700 wives and 300 concubines. He had a harem. Wisest man that ever lived, that's the dumbest thing that anybody ever did. How could you take care of more than one? That's a challenge, isn't it, guys? All right. But who are you going to get to guard that harem? Well, what they did is they took soldiers and castrated them where they'd have no sexual desires. And they put them in there. And then after a few hundred years, they figured out this is not good having all these women around, you know. And so that the harems just kind of passed out of existence. And then you had all of these men that they're not going to marry. And so what do? They become scholars. If you don't have a wife and children, you got time to study. And with those men, they became not just astrologers, though astrology comes from ancient Persia, but astronomers also. They studied the stars. And they would see when a new star appeared. Now, the closest that you and I have ever come to studying the stars, you can't do it much anymore, but when you could get out in the country where there are not any lights and just lay down on your back, and you can see the shooting stars. I think how many thousands of years it took just that light of that to get from where it was to where we are here. But they studied the stars, and there was a legend any time a new star appeared, and it wasn't just a shooting star, but just a new star appeared, it signaled the birth of a king. And so these wise men in the days of Jesus were over in Babylon studying the stars. And we know from Luke that a star appeared over the place where Jesus was born, in Bethlehem. They saw that star. Now, it took them probably 6 months to pack everything up. They couldn't go across the desert. You'd die. They had to go up the Euphrates River, up into Turkey, and then follow back down the water on the Mediterranean side there. And they show up in the palace of Herod the Great in Jerusalem, asking, "Where is he that is born King of the Jews?" Now, you know, it occurred to me that those men may have had the scroll of Daniel. And they may have read some of those things in Daniel that talk about the coming of Christ. How did they know to call him the King of the Jews? Well, for one thing, that was the only country that was there. Between Babylon and the Mediterranean Sea, you had that big desert, and then you have Judea or Israel there. Well, where is he that is to be born the king of Judea, the king of the Jews? And Herod is greatly disturbed. Why? He's the king of the Jews. That was his title that the Roman emperors had given him from the time that he put down the Galilean Jewish revolt. That was his title. And so, you know, Herod's half Jew. A lot of people don't realize that. His mother was a Jew. And he's interested in Judaism. He's the one who refurbished that second temple. It's Herod's temple, it's referred to, that Jesus worshipped in when he was here on this earth. So you have Herod then calling the scribes. Now, why didn't he call the priest? Well, the scribes were the scholars. They were the religious scholars. And so he called them. I mean, these were the people that really they came out of making hand copies of the Old Testament. So they would know the Old Testament. So he called them and asked, "Does the Old Testament tell us where the Messiah is going to be born?" And they quoted Micah 5:2. Bethlehem, though you're little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of you shall come forth to me the one is to be the ruler in Israel, and not just an ordinary king. This is the king whose goings forth have been from of old, from everlasting. You know, when Jesus is born, it's the first time that a baby was older than his mother. little town of Bethlehem. Now, you know, here in this insignificant Judean town, it was still insignificant in Herod's day, about 5 miles south of Jerusalem, Jesus was to be born. Mary was probably a teenager, but the child that she bore that Christmas night was, Christmas Eve, was as old as eternity. This was the Son of God, the everlasting, literally in the Hebrew, it's the days of eternity, very God of very God, the second person of the Trinity, became a person, became a man, so that we might be able to become children of God. That unique mixture of the human and divine is found only in Jesus, not in anybody else in all of history. And Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Now, why Bethlehem? That's an interesting question to ask. And some of this you can just get out of this passage that's there. You are little among the thousands. You say, well, Bethlehem, because the Old Testament prophesied it. Well, that's true. But why was Bethlehem the God-given place of the birth of the Messiah? Why was it chosen? Well, when you get into Luke chapter 2, you go to Bethlehem. It came to pass in those days that a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed, registered for taxation. And this census first took place while Quirinius was governing Syria. And so everybody went to be registered, and they had to go back to their hometown. Why? Weren't any courthouses, weren't any state records, birth records anywhere. All the birth records were in the synagogues. And so you had to go back to your hometown because that was the list that the Romans were checking off. All right, this one has registered. This one has registered to pay his taxes. And so Joseph also went up from Galilee out of the city of Nazareth into Judea to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of Bethlehem. Isn't the providence of God interesting to look at in these things? To be registered with Mary, his betrothed wife, who's with child. And so it was that while they were there, the days were completed for her to be delivered. And she brought forth her firstborn son, wrapped him in swaddling clothes, laid him in a manger, because there was no room for them in the inn. Bethlehem, the prophesied birthplace of Jesus the Christ, or Jesus the Messiah. A little town. I wonder, as you look at Bethlehem, if it was a little more than that, as to why God chose Bethlehem for the birth of the Christ. 1 Chronicles 2:51 describes Bethlehem as being founded by Salma. Salma, well, you don't know that name, but you know his father, Caleb. Remember Caleb and Joshua? Caleb and Joshua were the only two of the 12 spies that were sent out to spy out the land that brought back a positive report. During that 40 years of wandering, everybody died except Joshua and Caleb. They were the only two that had come out of Egypt that survived that wilderness wandering. Caleb, at one point in there, he says to Joshua, I'm 85 years old. Now, he's still fighting. He's still leading an army, you know. He's the Charlie Wood of that day, you know. I asked Charlie, how you feel? He says, mean as ever, you know. And Caleb said, give me this mountain. And the mountain is where the town of Hebron is today, which is in Palestinian territory, which is a sad thing, but it is. The Palestinians have destroyed a lot of the archaeological things over there, try to prove that the Jews were never there. But give me this mountain. Well, Bethlehem is there by Hebron, close to Hebron there, in that area, in that territory, Bethlehem of Ephrathah. So, you know, from the inception, Bethlehem has been a place of contrast, like the great struggle and the greater victory of Caleb, who was the grandfather of the city, so to speak. His son Salma was the father of the city. And the history of Bethlehem, I think, qualified it to be the birthplace of Jesus Christ. In what way? Well, first of all, the history of Bethlehem was a mixture of sorrow and joy. In Genesis 35, Rachel dies, and Abraham buries her at Bethlehem. The birth of Jesus, like every other human birth, jeopardized the life of the mother. You know, Rachel died in giving birth to Benjamin, her second son. Travail and pain precede bringing forth, and that's talked about here in this fifth chapter of Micah. You know, until the time that she who is in labor has given birth in there. And the birth of Jesus, like any other human birth, occurred under the shadow of death. When a baby is born, the mother's heartbeat, her respiration, her blood pressure, all are challenged. She literally goes down into the valley of the shadow of death in order to give birth to life. And then you have in this history of Bethlehem, this is where that slaughter of the innocents took place. Because Herod told those wise men, go down to Bethlehem, and when you find him, come back and tell me where he is so I can worship him. Well, they were smart enough to figure out that that wasn't his motive. And I think that the Lord impressed them as well. So they went back home another way and didn't come back and tell him. And when he realized they're not coming back, that's when he sent his soldiers down there to kill every boy baby under 2 years of age. Some think that that may be how old Jesus was at that time. He was certainly not a little baby anymore. By the time the wise men get there, they're not in a stable. They're in a house. The Bible says, Jesus is not a baby. He is a young child, toddler, holding on to his mother's knee. So he's pulling up already, maybe walking already. Year and a half, 2 years old. And so kill every boy baby under 2 years of age. Because he had asked the wise men, when did you see this star? Now, I wish that that were recorded in the New Testament. We'd have a lot more accuracy about exactly when Jesus was born, the fact that he said kill every boy baby under two made me think they told him one and a half years ago, something like that. Slaughter of the innocents under Herod. The slaughter of the 6.5 million Jews under Hitler. The slaughter of 23 million unborn babies in America, 25 million, I think it's up to 50 million up to now. And the shadow of death upon the birth of Christ was different from all of these because Jesus was born to die. It used to be the Prairie Bible Institute in Canada is a great, great school still to this day. Very, very sound in their doctrine. And for about 40 years, they had a man by the name of Ellie Maxwell. I tell my students, if you run across anything by Ellie Maxwell, buy it, you know, because he was a great Bible expositor. And the title of the book, the first book that I read by him was Born to Die. That's why Jesus was born. He was born to die. And Bethlehem has that mixture of sorrow and joy mixed in. And then, secondly, the history of Bethlehem was a mixture of bitterness and blessing. You run into Bethlehem again in the book of Ruth. That was her hometown. And Naomi's hometown. And you know that story, how there was a famine in the land. And so Naomi and her husband went to Moab because they wouldn't starve to death there. There was water there out of those mountains. And they had two sons, and then Naomi's husband died, and then the two boys died. And so here are these three women, this mother-in-law and two daughters-in-law, and she says to them, I've got to go back to my hometown, but you don't need to go there. You're not a Jew, you're a Moabite, and you need to go back to your family. But one of them, by the name of Ruth, said, no, I'm staying with you. That's one of the most beautiful passages in the Bible. Whither thou goest, I will go. Whither thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. And so they get back to Bethlehem, and they are as poor as Job's turkey. I mean, they're poor. She's having literally to beg. It becomes one of the gleaners. Almost every Baptist church, Southern Baptist church in the world in the last century has a gleaners class, Sunday school class in it. Naomi was too old to do it. So Ruth goes and she gleans in the field. And out of that, she meets Boaz. That's one of the most beautiful, the romance of redemption in the book of Ruth is a beautiful, beautiful thing. But you have that bitterness. They've lost their husband. Ruth has lost her husband. And her father-in-law is dead. And they are reduced to begging. But then you have that joy when she becomes the chosen bride of Boaz. Naomi's name in Hebrew means pleasant. And when she got back to Bethlehem, she says, is this Naomi? And she said, no, call me Mara. Bitter. You know, my life has been bitter now. But then they wind up being in the lineage of Jesus. Actually, you've got Ruth is the grandmother of King David. The bitterness and the blessing in Bethlehem's history well suited it to be the birthplace of Christ. The name Bethlehem qualified it to be the birthplace of Christ. Bethlehem means Beth is house, Lehem is bread, house of bread. In John chapter 6, in one of those great I Am passages where Jesus is talking, he says, I am the bread of life. We sang about that this morning. Break thou the bread of life. I am the bread of life. John chapter 6, verse 32-35. And then it's in the province of Ephrathah. Ephrathah means fruitfulness or abundance. And Jesus said in John 10:10, I am come that you might have life, and that you might have it more abundantly. The very name of Bethlehem qualified it to be the birthplace of the bread of life. And then the size and position of Bethlehem qualified it to be the birthplace of Christ. O little town of Bethlehem, though you are little among the thousands of Judah. You know, today there are only 10,000 residents in Bethlehem. It's still a small town. Helena, who was the mother of Constantine, Constantine being the first Roman emperor to become a Christian and really Christianized the Roman Empire at that time, his mother took a pilgrimage to the Holy Land to try to see these places. She went to Bethlehem. This is about AD 330 that she went to Bethlehem. They showed her a little cave where they thought Jesus had been born. And on top of it, she built a church, the Church of the Nativity that still stands today. The Samaritans destroyed it in 521 A.D. 6 years later, Justinian rebuilt it. In 614, the Persians destroyed every church in the area except that one, because it had a mosaic on the front of it picturing the three magi from Persia. They came there. The Crusaders repaired it in the 12th century. King Edward IV of England resealed it, put a new ceiling in the 14th century with cedar covered by lead. The Turks stripped the lead off to make bullets during World War I. An earthquake in 1927 damaged every church except that church. Didn't damage that one. And in 1955, they were digging down to inspect the footing of these huge columns that were there. And they found that first floor, a mosaic that Helena had built into that. And you can see that today. And underneath there is a cave where they say Jesus was born. And another cave where they kept the sheep. You know, in Jesus' day, Bethlehem was smaller than it is today. The inns were little more than stalls opening onto a common courtyard. The closest thing that I could imagine that are the flop houses in Chicago. I think they probably have some here in Dallas now, where they've gone into a building, put up chicken wire to make little 10-by-10 places where people can sleep overnight. And that's kind of what those inns were, and they were all full. And so he said, you can stay in the barn. You can stay down in the cave. Little stalls were usually built out of limestone. The caves were limestone caves, and you can take a pickaxe and carve out limestone. And they had that lower entrance for the animals. So the animals were in the basement parking lot down there is where they were. And the people camped out above. They brought their own food. They cooked it out in the courtyard. The innkeepers only furnished the place and the hay to feed the animals. And each lower stable had a manger. A manger is a feed trough. In our nativity scenes, it's almost always an English feed trough built out of wood. But these were stone. You can still find them over there. They were long stones that had been hollowed out where they'd put the hay or they'd put the water in there. And they took one of those, put hay in it, put these swaddling clothes, these soft cloths on there. And there the Lord and Savior of mankind, the King of kings and Lord of lords, comes to live in a little place. Aren't you glad? And to be received into little hearts. It's not coincidental that God's people are referred to by Jesus as his little ones. Dr. Criswell seemed like once a month would say at the end of the service, "Fear not, little flock. It's the Father's good favor that you should inherit the kingdom in there." Christ was not born in New York City. He was not born in Chicago, Ruby. Sorry about that. Or Atlanta, Jim. Or Dallas, or Houston, or Phoenix, or Los Angeles. He was not born in London, or Tokyo, or Moscow, or Rio, or San Paulo, or Mexico City. He was not even born in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv. He was born in the little town of Bethlehem. And he does not seek the rich and the famous, the powerful and the influential, the brilliant and the gifted in which to dwell. He was born in a cave, laid in a manger, and is quite at home in our hearts. And if you are a little one, take hope and take heart. Jesus comes to little places, plain places, humble hearts. The plainness of the humblest soul but magnified the greatness of his glory. The King of kings and Lord of lords comes down to eat with us. Come and dine, says the Master. Come and dine. You can feast at Jesus' table all the time. Oh, little town of Bethlehem. The year was 1865. It was Christmas Eve. The Civil War had just ended. And people were traveling again. And there was a famous preacher. You might not have heard his name because he was not a Baptist. He was an Episcopalian. But There were actually two preachers in that 19th century who were called, had the title, the Prince of Preachers. One of them was in England, Charles Spurgeon, a Baptist. The other was in Philadelphia at Holy Trinity Episcopal Church, and that was Phillips Brooks. He was not only a famous preacher, but he was a hymn writer. And before he was full grown, he had memorized over 200 hymns. His mother said that as a boy, you could always tell when he got up because he'd start singing. As a pastor, he wrote hymns for his church. And on one occasion, at least, for his Sunday school. Sunday school back then was for children. Brooks had returned from Bethlehem with a song in his heart that he turned over in his mind for 3 years before an eventful Saturday evening, which was Christmas Eve, and the next day was Christmas Day, and on a Sunday. And he wrote a Christmas hymn to be sung in Sunday school. And the organist was a man named Lewis Redner, and he was practicing that Saturday, so Brooks asked him to put the words to music and sing it the next morning to the children. O little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie, above thy deep and dreamless sleep, the silent years go by. Thou, Bethlehem, Ephrathah, though you're little among the towns of Judah, yet out of you shall come forth to me the one to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth are from old, from everlasting. Aren't you thankful for Bethlehem? Brother Jack?